Welcome back to the 2 Degrees Show, the weekly climate change programme that's made for Resonance 104.4 FM in London and syndicated to community radio stations in the UK and beyond. As a global community, we are in a race between the climate system that we are pushing out of balance on the one hand, and the capacity of our political system to respond to the challenge of stabilising that climate on the other. The most eminent climate scientist in the US and head of NASA, James Hansen, thinks that we have already passed a critical tipping point in the climate system. He says that there is already sufficient carbon in the atmosphere to melt the ice in the Arctic and on Greenland. Later in the programme, we'll be discussing Hansen's conclusion that we need to stabilise concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere at a lower level than they currently are, as soon as we possibly can. We'll also be hearing about Climate Code Red, a new report that uses Hansen's work as its point of departure, and suggests that in order to not be overtaken by events, we need to start defining and responding to our predicament as an emergency. In the first half of today's programme, we continue our look at the efforts of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change to accurately predict the results of the experiment that we are now conducting on the climate. Here's Dr. Stuart Parkinson, Executive Director of Scientists for Global Responsibility, who was an expert reviewer for the IPCC's third assessment report back in 2001.
Another paper of Hansen suggests that West Antarctica seems to be moving into a mode of significant mass loss as well, and that isn't something that is suggested by the IPCC?
No, again, this is a difficult one because on the one hand, across the whole of Antarctica, you've got two separate processes going on. You've got the ice flowing faster into the sea and disintegrating faster at the edges, but you've got an increase in precipitation in the middle. And the whole of Antarctica is roughly in balance, and it's one of the things that climate skeptics point to and say the Arctic might be thinning, but Antarctica as a whole isn't, so we don't need to worry. But yes, so the critical factor is West Antarctica, which is a smaller part of the whole Antarctic ice sheet, and that's the one where you're seeing icebergs calving off at the edge and it moving faster into the ocean. It could drive up the sea level rise a lot quicker. Hansen argues that a lot of the models that have been used to come up with the IPCC assessment are based too much on theoretical considerations and not enough on paleoclimate data, data from the last X thousand years into the past. And he argues that that data shows that once ice sheets start to melt, they rapidly disintegrate. And that's far faster than any of the models show. And the models, because they're based on recent observations only over a shorter time period, can't show this rapid nonlinear disintegration. The scary thing is, of course, he could be right, but a lot of others are arguing that whilst it will be faster than the IPCC projections say, it's not going to be several metres this century, which is one of the things he estimates.
Are there any other ways in which you think the IPCC are conservative? There's the allegation that the summaries for policymakers, because they're agreed by political representatives or scientific representatives of all the countries involved, there's an opportunity there for people with vested interests, and the US have obviously been traditionally...
The basic process is you can only argue that things shouldn't be included if you can make a strong scientific argument. And if people think that you're just arguing politically and the science isn't clear, then they will challenge you. But obviously, science and politics aren't completely independent by any stretch of the imagination. So, yes, it does allow people to say, well, you know, that's uncertain, so we shouldn't include that bit of data. There was an argument about what percentage level should be said for we are certain that climate change is due to human activities, and I think the argument was over very likely or extremely likely. They ended up going for very likely because not enough of the political representatives were happy with extremely likely. I mean, I saw interviews with scientists at the time who said basically, well, because Bush is having so many troubles at home and the administration is in deep trouble politically, they were less challenging into the IPCC process than they would have been had it been 2 or 3 years ago. So again, I think there is a way in which data which has a higher level of uncertainty doesn't get into the summary because it's just to more controversial, and that politics will affect that.
One thing I remember was Roger Harabin on the Today programme reported that the following sentence had been removed from the summary for policymakers. Mm. North America is expected to experience locally severe economic damage plus substantial ecosystem, social and cultural disruption from climate change related events. So, you know, the suspicion there is, of course, because it's US related impacts, there's a political
consequence.
Because you can downplay the calls for climate mitigation action in the United States.
Yeah. Because the climate models are generally good at the global level, regional estimates are much more uncertain, so it is far easier for those who want to argue, no, we haven't got enough level of certainty to include that detail in there. And yeah, I have to be honest, I hadn't heard that particular example, but I can well believe it.
What about treatments of feedbacks and tipping points in the IPCC report overall? Do you think they've been dealt with adequately? I mean, people have charged that they haven't been, and that the importance of feedbacks have been downplayed, and tipping points as well.
They've said more about them this time. I think it's better than it was.
Has the carbon cycle feedback now been included in the models?
Which one?
The stuff that Peter Cox was talking about.
Yeah, there are many aspects of it. There's things like the potential disintegration of places like the Amazon rainforest under the temperature stress leading to dieback, and then rapid dieback of particularly the Amazon rainforest, but other rainforests as well, which then releases lots of carbon. So that's one positive feedback. Then you've got another one that's as carbon in the ocean increases, the ocean can take up less carbon from the atmosphere, and that's included to a certain extent. But there's an argument that that's increasing more rapidly, and so the ocean is going to take up less CO2 than we thought it would. There has been more about feedbacks in this report, and so they are talking about them, and they are starting to put numbers on them in a way that they weren't before, and they appear in the executive summary. They talk about 1.9 to 4.6 degrees of prolonged warming will lead to disintegration of the Greenland and West Antarctic ice sheet. And then they say, well, that will take centuries to millennia. And then you have James Henderson saying, well, no, that could take a century or two. The argument that it could take millennia is based on more theoretical data than observational data. And he argues the observational data is what you should be basing the estimates on. Because you have to go through all these committees, through all these scientists, and then through this political approval process at the top. And because identifying tipping points is so hard to do in such a complex system, that most of this stuff is not going to make it into the summaries beyond the sort of, there are tipping points, there are these feedbacks, could be a problem, but we don't know the details. And then you have a lengthy discussion in the report itself, which steps back from saying anything like 2 degrees is dangerous climate change or anything of that magnitude, and it's left to individual scientists to stand up and say, well, in my opinion, 2 degrees is dangerous, or whatever particular level they want to talk about.
There was a paper by David Wasdell, I don't know if you ever came across that, he kind of did some analysis of...
I think I shared a platform with him about a year ago at a climate conference.
Yeah, you kind of...
Meridian Institute or something like that?
Yeah, and he's also a reviewer.
Oh, right.
Well, he's critical of the IPCC of not including feedback dynamics, and he points to seabed clath rates and says that there's actually early evidence of that confirmed by NASA.
Right.
I don't know if that's correct or not. I'm assuming it is.
I'm afraid I don't know about that one.
Okay, and that would be an amplifying feedback.
Yeah.
If that's happening, then permafrost also he's saying.
Yeah.
Permafrost, which is important, isn't it? Because that's a
releases methane,
which is again possibly starting to happen.
I've seen the observations from Russia. Not enough people wandering around in that part of the world taking measurements, and suddenly.
Right.
When there was an expedition up there, that was it last year, and they suddenly found the emissions are a lot higher than they expected.
So it seems that the science could be lagging behind observation actual effects in a lot of these areas.
This is one of the problems about science in general. there's this trade-off between early warnings that something might be very bad and, you know, the sort of 90% certainty that where you can say, yeah, this is happening and we're pretty sure of this, and it's fairly unambiguous. And that's quite a long process that you have to go to, and particularly if you're collecting observational data on a global scale, that's expensive and takes time. And when you get things like George Bush cutting the NASA Earth observation budget in order to fund manned space missions because that's more glamorous, then you end up with cuts in the data collection that can give you the evidence that points to the warming happenings. Hansen, actually, he did publish a paper at the end of last year, and he was arguing about this process of scientific conservatism is that sometimes you just have to stick your neck out as a scientist and say, well, you know, I think it's bad enough to take action long before you've got consensus or the sort of 90% certainty whereby something becomes an established fact.
In terms of targets, I was discussing this with Joe Haig the other day, just the fact that none of the IPCC scenarios now keep us within 2 degrees C of global average temperature compared to pre-industrial times. And I think we're at the upper limit of all the scenarios that the IPCC use in terms of CO2 emissions. And up until now, the EU have been arguing that 2 degrees C is a kind of unbreachable limit, that because beyond that, is they would define it as dangerous. So we're going to need to start thinking much more radically than we were before if we're going to even keep within 2 degrees C. And Hansen is arguing that actually we should probably not saying that 2 degrees C is safe, and that 1.7 degrees C or 0.5 degrees C, I think he's even said recently, should be what we're aiming for. And in order to do that, we need to, I mean, I'll quote him again. He says, may be achievable by phasing out coal use, except where CO2 is captured.
Yeah.
So the idea of
carbon capture and storage.
Yeah. And adopting agricultural and forestry practices that sequester carbon. So that's the kind of level we should be looking at, he's suggesting.
Yeah. It is interesting. I've had an increasing number of people that are starting to say, well, the only thing that's going to save us now is all these speculative geoengineering projects. And what was it? Walter Broecker, who's an American climate scientist, was arguing we need GM super trees to take up CO2 much more quickly. Lovelock came up with his deep ocean pumps. They stick big vertical pipes into the sea and you pump carbon dioxide down right into the bottom of the deep ocean. And then you've got all the aerosol shields and stuff like that. I mean, I'm very unhappy about a lot of these things. The potential for them to backfire and give us more problems than the ones they're trying to sort out. Or at least just divert resources away from things that actually we know are going to make a positive contribution compared with these things which are very speculative and we don't know whether they'll even work. I think one of the biggest warnings about this has been the dash for biofuels that we now have. That was done so quickly, and interestingly, that wasn't done for climate change reasons. That was done from energy security reasons and being driven by the US more than anything.
Yeah. Also driven by high fuel prices, because it becomes more advantageous for people to turn cereals into fuel as the oil price rises.
Yeah. And that's just an example of going for a quick solution which has backfired badly. And this is the trouble. We have on the one hand the argument that we need to take action very quickly, and on the other hand, if you go for the wrong solution too quickly, you've just got all sorts of other problems that are worse than what you're trying to, or at least in the short term, are worse than what you're trying to tackle, which makes it all the more important to the solutions that you suggest must have co-benefits and must have be integrated with other strategies, whether they're development or anti-poverty strategies or biodiversity loss prevention strategies or all these things. You have to try and link them together. It's something that we keep coming back to in SGR, and it's like whatever solution you try and propose for this, actually the best one is that we just have to cut demand and cut consumption.
Yeah.
And actually there's a lot of technologies around that can help you do that, and a lot of benefits of living a low consumption lifestyle in terms of social and community benefits.
That was Dr. Stuart Parkinson, Executive Director of Scientists for Global Responsibility, who was an expert reviewer for the IPCC's third assessment report back in 2001. If our political system is to get to grips with the climate problem, surely the first thing it needs is an accurate assessment of our predicament. We need to look the problem in the eye. If we are setting targets too low due to an assessment which is overly cautious, then we are highly unlikely to solve the problem. A new report is about to be published in Australia that defines our situation as an emergency. It's called Climate Code Red and takes its cue from recent scientific findings and observations, including the work of James Hansen and his team. Amongst its conclusions is the idea that a 2 degrees centigrade rise in global average temperature can no longer be regarded as safe. To find out more, I spoke to Richard Hawkins of the Public Interest Research Centre, who is working on producing a UK version of the report for publication in a few weeks' time. Apologies in advance for the poor quality of the sound on this recording.
I mean, I guess all the science coming in seems to suggest that perhaps even 2 degrees C isn't any longer safe. And is it James Hansen that's been suggesting that the 0.5 degrees C should really be the level that we should be aiming for as a maximum, and that beyond that is possibly dangerous? Is that his assessment?
Well, the 0.5 degrees itself doesn't specifically come from James Hansen, but you're certainly right that 2 degrees is no longer the tipping point, it's no longer the target. Recent findings have shown that it's going to be much less than that. I mean, James Hansen's team published a report around a year ago which said that at 1.7 degrees we could see a runaway melting of the ice sheet, which could lead to a 5 meter sea level rise by the end of this century. And since then, we've discovered that the carbon sinks are reducing faster than we predicted. Species and ecosystems are more vulnerable than we'd expected. The permafrost is melting faster than we anticipated. But I think the most significant sign that 2 degrees is no longer the target is in the Arctic, where we're on track for it being ice-free in the summer of 2013. And the implications of that are profound. It's melting about 70 years ahead of the IPCC schedule. So the Arctic really is an enormous mirror, and it's reflecting 90% of the energy it receives. If it's ice-free, it's now absorbing 90%. It's just a large ocean. And the regional effects of adding such a heat engine will be around 5 degrees, which will be at least 0.3 degrees globally. Now, the knock-on effects of that are huge. And there's a report in Nature last week saying that 5 degrees regionally could penetrate up to 1,500 kilometres inland, which is going to inevitably lead to a significant permafrost melt. Now, there's enormous amounts of carbon locked up in that permafrost. So the heating and the extra implications on the Arctic are really profound.
I mean, Hansen's been tracking some of this, and also a team in Australia that have designed a project called Climate Code Red. Between them, they're suggesting a much lower stabilisation target for CO2 than has been agreed by policymakers to date. I mean, the UK government used to be talking about 550 parts per million being politically acceptable, and people like John Schellenhuber we had on the programme saying that a more responsible target was a 450 parts per million CO2 equivalent. Now, Hansen is suggesting that 300 to 350 parts per million of CO2 is kind of the dangerous level, and we're already beyond that. So he's suggesting we have a much, much bigger task on our hands. Can you talk us through some of these targets and where they come from?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, at the moment, we're working on producing a UK version of the Climate Code Red report. And what it's saying is that, really, if we look at the accelerating impacts, and if we look at what's happening in the Arctic, then our target needs to be much lower. And it's based on some work, like you said, that James Hansen has done, which is looking at the paleoclimate. So it's looking at ancient climates and seeing the changes that have happened previously. And what it's suggesting is that actually our climate is much more sensitive to CO2 and to radiative forcing than we thought. What this means potentially is that the target should be somewhere between 300 and 350 in the long term. Now, the main difficulty is, and even Hansen's team don't know this, is how far above that target we can go and how long we can stay above it. What we do know is that absolutely essential to the future stable climate is what happens in the Arctic. in the long term, if we have an ice-free Arctic, then all bets are off. So really what the Code Red project is saying is that we need to get atmospheric concentrations back down, lower than they are at the moment. So stabilisation as a policy is out, now we're talking about drawdown, and we need to get down to between 300 and 350. And that is the sort of concentrations that may help the Arctic to reform.
So Hansen's suggesting an initial target of 350 parts per million, but it's obviously saying that that should be tweaked as scientific understanding is improved.
Yeah.
Climate Code Red are proposing, what, 320 parts per million as a target?
Yeah, I mean, if you read the Hansen paper, what they're suggesting is that the safe target is somewhere between 300 and 350. But in the end, they lump for 300, as even they may be watering down their own targets. So Code Red is suggesting that 320 really is the precautionary principle based on these accelerating impacts.
Perhaps we can look at the kind of measures that Hansen is talking about to achieve A, stabilisation, and B, a drawdown, so that we're reducing the amount of CO2 that's in the atmosphere. Yep. What are the key measures that he's suggesting we take?
Well, it's becoming very clear that we're going to have to leave a substantial chunk of the fossil fuels that we know exist in the ground, particularly coal. So he's suggesting that we phase out coal set to where it's using carbon capture and storage in the next 30 years. Now, what James Hansen and a lot of other people are also just suggesting is that we enhance natural carbon sinks by undertaking a lot of different things that would sequester carbon. So that might include afforesting and reforesting large areas. It might include using biochar, that's sort of burning wood without oxygen so that you don't create CO2, and then tilling that into the soil and using it as a soil enhancement. It might also include using carbon capture and storage with biomass, for instance, rather than coal. There are lots of different areas where you may be able to enhance those carbon sinks, but really what that's about is delaying the Earth's natural capacity reducing over time so that we've got more of a chance to start reducing emissions and start reducing concentrations in the atmosphere. Lots of people are talking about air capture.
I mean, Hansen seems to suggest that that's something that we should be putting R&D money into.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think the key point at the moment is, as we know, fossil fuels are going to increase over the coming decades in price, that it will be actually a lot cheaper to decarbonise and reduce our reliance on fossil fuels than it will be to suck millions of tonnes of CO2 out of the atmosphere. So I think the real money needs to go into renewables. We can assess further down the line whether air capture is really necessary. But at the moment, it seems like a very expensive option. I mean, lots of people are talking about geoengineering at the moment. They're talking about human-induced cooling and the need for that. Because the added complication of if we reduce our emissions significantly is that part of those emissions are particulates or aerosols in the atmosphere. And they don't stay around very long. They only stay around for about 10 days. And at the moment, they're having a significant cooling effect. So if we were to reduce our emissions dramatically, say to zero over the next 20 years, then we would get an added kick of heating from the reduction in these aerosols, and that would happen before we reduced our emissions. So a lot of people are talking about some sort of geoengineering or added drawdown to cool the planet. The worry is, though, that governments will use this just to short-circuit difficult decisions on decarbonisation. So they'll twiddle their thumbs at international negotiations for another decade, panic, and then dump millions of tonnes of sulfates into the stratosphere, without really looking at the full consequences, particularly on the ozone layer or droughts, etc. So I think the key is that we get into emergency mode, we head down the road of zero carbon or decarbonisation, and then we think about some of those decisions and the implications.
But the timescale of this requires kind of immediate action and almost like an emergency footing.
Absolutely. I mean, all targets are really about risk. When scientists traverse from a target to a temperature, they'll give you a probability of achieving it. And it's something that's not really entered the public discourse at the moment. A lot of scientists just talk about, well, we're going to reduce emissions by X, and that will make sure that we avoid 2 degrees. Well, now we know that the target isn't 2 degrees, but we also need to reappraise what our actual targets are and how risky they really are. And when you do that, you start to realise that the existing targets we have for 2 degrees are incredibly risky. So in the UK, you have the Climate Bill, which is currently sort of lost in the corridors of the House of Commons, and that suggests a 60% cut in emissions by 2050, which the Tyndall Centre has already shown on last year's models would lead to a 4 or 5 degree warming. We have lots of large environmental NGOs lobbying on 80% by 2050, and they've spent thousands of hours and hundreds of thousands of pounds pushing for these targets. But we now know that 80% by 2050 is far too risky. So what we're really talking about now is as low as we can go, as quickly as we can get there, because that means that the concentrations in the atmosphere don't go too high so that it's impossible to come back down to that 350, 300 level. It's very important now that we minimise how high our emissions go.
you've had the advantage of reading the Climate Code Red report ahead of its publication. In terms of the kind of strategy that they are proposing to get us out of this business as usual scenario, which is actually at the upper end of all the emissions that have been predicted previously.
I think the main thing now, and I think that what the report suggests, is that we really do treat this as an emergency and we move into emergency mode, because not just business as usual, but politics as usual is really struggling with this, and that we'll need to see an emergency action plan drawn up. And we should stop talking about fractions of percentage of GDP, because we need a much larger effort than this. So I think we need planning, I think we need a huge grassroots movement to really push for these sort of changes.
And in terms of the practicality of doing this, Zero Carbon Britain has produced a kind of roadmap for the UK, which doesn't rely on these geoengineering projects as you were talking about, but actually fairly plausible scenarios for actually achieving this.
Zero Carbon Britain is another project that we work on, and it's a project from the Centre for Alternative Technology, and it's really the action plan that you wish the government had. And it simply asks, what could we really do? How much could we power down our energy use through efficiency, and how much could we power up renewables? And we're in the process at the moment of strengthening key areas of report. I think the second edition will be out sometime next year. And it really is trying to show that this isn't a technical problem, that renewables can deliver 100% of the energy we need, and they can do it cleanly and reduce our emissions almost 100% as well.
This is probably something that we should return to down the line, particularly after the Climate Code Red report comes out and people can digest some of the many implications of it.
The UK version should be published in around 6 weeks, and you can find it on our website at www.pirc.info.
So in a way that is parallel to what's happening politically, our programme is left with an outdated show title.
Yeah.
So from a communications point of view, would you have any ideas about what we might do? Should we call it the Half a Degree Show? Or I know there's a huge campaign starting now in the United States launched by Bill McKibben to rally around the 350 parts per million figure, suggesting that we're already beyond a safe place and we need to move back down the ladder.
I think temperature is always going to be more complicated, and a 0.5 degree target, it's difficult to tell even whether it's possible now. 350 we know we can achieve, so I think the 350 show has a nice ring to it.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was Richard Hawkins from the Public Interest Research Centre in Powys, Wales. And apologies again for the quality of the sound on that recording. We'll give further consideration to a possible name change for the programme over the coming week. In the meantime, links and references for this week's programme can be found up on the Climate Radio archive in a few days' time at www.climateradio.co.uk. Over the next couple of weeks, we'll be looking at the critical issues of coal and biofuels in the lead-up to the various camps for climate action that are happening around the world during July and August. And we'll leave you with the words of Dr. James Hansen, speaking remotely to the Royal College of Physicians earlier this year about our chances of maintaining a climate suited to human civilization.
I think that it's possible that we will reach a turning point, we will reach a tipping point, and begin to move in the direction of the changes that would be needed in order to stabilize climate. You know, that's why I'm trying to encourage that if either the United Kingdom or Germany would put a moratorium on new coal-fired power plants until we have the technology to capture the CO2. Then I think next year, when we have a new administration in the U.S., it may be possible to encourage the U.S. to follow that. And then we could have a tipping point where we begin to move policies in the direction that would solve the problem. But as things stand, we're just going right down the business-as-usual path. And if we continue on that path for another decade or so, then there's no hope of keeping CO2 anywhere close to the limits that I think are essential.